now, as he usually was, jotting notes in his tiny journal. They were numbers, although it was not arithmetic. It was a sentence written in the language he and Beatrice had invented. Translated, it meant, "I believe Antonia's dogs killed some men last night." Here was a thing Francisco wanted, to find a pitch-black bud on one of his roses. Here was a thing he feared, being asked to do anything else. Antonia sneered again at her husband's figure, her temper warming again, and then she turned away. She pointed beyond the cistern. "That over there is the truck." Pete felt a surge of gladness over the reality of the vehicle. If he tried hard enough, he could imagine his logo painted on its stained side. "Thank you, ma'am, for this opportunity."
"Don't thank me yet. I don't think he's running."
She halted in front of a long and utilitarian adobe structure.
"This is where you'll be staying. We're up to God's mustache in Pilgrims, so you'll have a roommate."
"I don't mind, ma'am."
"You might,"
Antonia said. The house Pete was to stay in had originally housed Daniel Lupe Soria's family, although it would have been difficult to identify it as a family home now, because it had since been divided into tiny apartments. Inside it was dark and cool, smelling of unfamiliar foods and years of wood smoke.
"Kitchen,"
Antonia said by way of tour,
"clean up after yourself."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Water closet,"
Antonia said, opening a door,
"clean up after yourself."
"Yes, ma'am."
"These rooms have pilgrims in them, so obviously don't enter without an invitation,"
Antonia said, gesturing to the four doors along the hall that stretched the length of the home.
"Yes, ma'am."
To prevent stuffiness in the house, all of these doors were open, and so in this way Pete met the pilgrims who shared the house with him. In the first room was Jenny Fitzgerald, a slight young brunette woman who waved at him as they passed.
"Hello,"
said Pete.
"Hello,"
said Jenny. He didn't know it, but he just heard the result of her first miracle. It had left her with the inability to say anything but what other people had already said. She was the most obviously determined of the pilgrims to remove the darkness from herself. Since her first miracle, she had spent her days actively seeking conversation with others. Her conversation partner would speak first, and then Jenny would try to reply in her own words, executing invisible techniques in an attempt to do more than simply echo. So far, the only success she'd had was in making the other pilgrims dread conversation with her, which was too bad, because she really was a nice young lady. Pete nearly did not see the pilgrim in the second room they passed, as he blended in with the shadows of his room so well. This was Theldon Bunch. The first miracle had left him with moss furring his entire body, and now he spent his days either in the rocker in the corner of his room, or under the shaded patio beside the house, reading fat paperback novels that the postman brought from Alamosa. He had the same amount of moss covering his skin as he'd had the day the miracle had created it, and he did not appear to be doing anything to combat it.
"Hello,"
Pete said to him, but Theldon Bunch did not look up from his book until after Pete and Antonia had already passed. The third room contained the glamorous California twins, Robbie and Betsy, who, after the miracle, were corded together by an enormous black snake with a head at both ends. It tangled their feet if they took too many steps away from each other, but it also snapped at them if they sat too close for too long. If one side of it was attacked, the other side came to the rescue. If it was fed constantly and kept at a continuously acceptable tension, they could carry on without noticing it. The twins had arrived at Bicho Raro, alternately fighting and clinging, and remained thus. It had occurred to Beatrice, at the very least, that the solution was for a twin to hold one of the snake's heads while the other twin killed the second head, but of course she could not suggest such a thing. So they continued to complain that the snake was too strong for them to battle on their own, and lived with it wrapped around them both.
Hello, Pete said to them.
He was turned slightly more toward Robbie, so the snakehead nearest Betsy jealously snapped at him. Pete's heart leaped first, and then his body leaped second. His back hit the hallway wall and his hand slapped his dangerously shocked heart. Betsy drew the snake up short.
"So sorry,"
she said, but she was looking at Robbie as if it were Robbie's fault.
"Sure, that's okay, miss,"
Pete said, although he wasn't sure if it really was.
"I'm Pete."
"Pete,"
Betsy repeated, but she was looking at Robbie as if this, too, were Robbie's fault. Robbie refused to look at her. They were fighting.
"Wyatt," Antonia said, farther down the hall.
"So long,"
Pete told the twins and caught up. Antonia had not spoken to any of the pilgrims they had passed. Pete was remembering how the Sorias had ignored him as he knocked on their doors, and he was thinking about how now she was ignoring these people, and he was thinking it was pretty rude. He was too polite to say anything about it, though. He just kept looking over his shoulder at the three rooms they'd passed. Antonia was no fool, so she stopped before the final room and put a hand on Pete's shoulder.
"You are thinking I'm a pig."
"No, ma'am."
"You are. I can see it on your face."
"No, ma'am."
"Now you're being a liar and thinking I'm a pig, but that's all right. I understand. We have rules here, Pete, but they don't have to do with you. We Sorias must be careful with pilgrims. If we interfere with them after the first miracle, our own darkness will come down on us, and that is a terrible thing that no one would like to see, worse than any of their darkness. So, that is the first rule. Only room and board for the pilgrims, no other conversation, because you don't know what will help them. Rule two, if you want a wife or you want a husband, you go outside Bicho Raro. Love is a dangerous thing already, without a pilgrim in it. Rule three, only a saint performs the miracle, and no one else around, because you don't know when the darkness will bite like that snake you just saw. These are the rules."
"Yes, ma'am," Pete said.
He wasn't sure what he was expected to say, as he was not a Soria and the rules didn't apply to him, but he also could see that it was a grave issue and wanted Antonia to see that he realized this.
"That's why I'm not talking to the pilgrims," Antonia said.
"Yes, ma'am."
"It's not because I'm a pig."
"No, ma'am."
"That's why no one came to talk to you, because we thought you were a pilgrim."
"Yes, ma'am."
"I'm telling you because all of the pilgrims know, and you should too, so that you know what a Soria will or won't do, and you know we're not being rude."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good. Here's your room,"
Antonia said, closing the distance to the final doorway.
"Clean up after yourself."
"Yes, ma'am,"
Pete said. Antonia leaned toward the room but did not look inside it.
"Padre, this boy will be your roommate. He can have the floor."
She was walking away before she even finished speaking. "Come find Michael or myself when you're ready to work, Wyatt." The final room in the hall belonged to Padre Jimenez, a priest from northern Colorado. He was as benevolent and friendly and holy as you'd hope for a priest to be, so long as your skirt didn't blow up in the wind. The first miracle had left him with the head of a coyote, but the hands of a man. He used the first to gobble up rabbits, and the second to fasten on his white collar each morning. He did try to vanquish the darkness, but he could not stop his coyote's ears from pricking when a pretty girl came to Bicho Raro. When Pete stepped into the doorway, Padre Jimenez was sitting at the end of a narrow mattress. The bed was made up as tidily as a business envelope, and there was nothing else in the room but a small table with a lamp on it and a cross hanging on the wall. At this sight, the spare decor, the coyote-headed man, the grimly made bed, Pete suddenly felt a second shock through him. This one was not surprise, but homesickness. An understanding of how far he was from Oklahoma, in every way. A fear that his plan was nothing but smoke tricks to fool himself into feeling better. The ferocity of this emotion sent an additional wave through his heart. And for the first time, Pete really believed that Pete the doctor may have been onto something, and that was a leash that felt shorter. And so it was a somewhat more feeble version of Pete that Padre first saw. Some might argue a truer version, if they are one of those who believes we are only as strong as our weakest moments. Luckily for Pete and for many people, Padre Jimenez was not one of them. The priest leaped up and loped across the room to Pete. "Welcome, young man," he said. He had a very crisp enunciation because he had to work hard to get the words out around his sharp canines and lolling tongue. "Welcome, welcome, welcome." Pete, like many a young rural Protestant, reeled back first from the priestly collar and second from the coyote head.
"Oh, sir, thank you."
Padre Jimenez waited until the silence had become slightly uncomfortable, and then he gobbled it up with his flashing teeth. "Ah, so have you had your miracle yet?"
"I'm just here about a truck," Pete said. "Just here to work."
"Is that so?"
"Just a truck."
"No secret darkness lurking inside you?" Pete found himself once again telling the story of his Aunt Josefa. "Of course, of course, of course," Padre Jimenez said. "Josefa, wonderful lady, though a little progressive. We court darkness when we swim nude."
"Do we?"
Pete asked. "Do you?"
Pete halted the conversation and restarted it. "Are you still... do you still... are you a priest here?"
"I am always a priest in my heart. Are you a Catholic?"
"I'm a Christian."
"Lucky," Padre Jimenez said. "So am I. Say, you came with the man last night, didn't you?"
Pete had not thought about Tony since waking up in his car.
But the jolt of homesickness he'd just felt had the effect of softening the memory of his trip with Tony. His mind skipped over all the negative aspects, and instead highlighted the camaraderie of the shared hours together. Just a decade before, a scientist named Harry Harlow had studied the science of attachment by performing experiments on monkeys. The poor infant monkeys had been deprived of their real mothers, but offered two substitutes. An artificial monkey covered with terry cloth and an artificial monkey made of wire. A terry cloth mother is not much of a mother at all, but all of the infant monkeys agreed she was better than the wire mother. Harlow had not studied young men from Oklahoma in this experiment, but the results still held true for Pete. Padre and the other strange pilgrims felt like a wire mother to Pete, and the specter of Tony, though only a snarling terry cloth mother, seemed to at least offer a semblance of comfort.
"Yes, I did come with him," Pete said now. "Where is he? Is he still here?"
"Oh, yes, yes." Padre Jimenez gestured out the tiny window. Together, they peered out the window, but Pete did not see Tony. He saw the bright day, and a swath of shade across it. Pete's eyes followed that long, stretching shadow, deep blue in the late morning light. Shielding his eyes against the sun, he tipped his head back and then farther back, trying to clearly see what enormous structure cast it. He saw a smooth, white surface stretching two stories up, with seams like enormous stitching. He did not understand the top of it, which was dark and so black as to be violet. It was not until he lowered his eyes to look at the base of the structure and saw a single vast bare foot that he realized what he was looking at, because he remembered clearly Antonia Soria's dogs eating the shoe that had been on it. Now he understood that the white surface was yards of white suit and that the black that topped it was a field of shiny hair, all of it the same as he had seen it the night before, except 3 times larger.
Holy moly, Pete said. Is that Tony?
Chapter 8. While Pete was eyeballing Tony's new stature, Beatrice was finally discovering Danielle's letter. Danielle was not much of a letter writer. He was a slow reader and a slower writer, often reversing letters inside a word and sometimes transcribing numbers facing the wrong direction. His ears were more cunning than his hands, so he was easily distracted by any noises while he worked. He could not write while anyone was speaking to him, or else he would accidentally pen the words he heard spoken. In fact, before he was the saint of Bicho Raro, he and his friends had driven into town after dark to paint the side of the local grocery. They were painting the grocery because the owner's son had spoken unfavorably of the Soria family during the school day, and they were arriving after dark because they presumed correctly that the grocer did not want his building painted. Danielle, the bravest, was given the role of painting, and so he began to slowly apply the words, in Spanish for his friends, who were not bilingual like the Soria children, as the others kept watch, being careful to not form the letter E backward. He had intended to paint the proverb, "Vivir con miedo es como vivir a medias." A life lived in fear is a life half-lived. But his fellows, too drunk and jolly to cleave close to that noble sentiment, began to softly chant as Danielle painted, knowing how his letters would obey them rather than him. He ended up decorating the building instead with "Vivir con mierda es como vivir a medias," which has a different meaning, as the corruption of only 2 letters transforms miedo from fear to shit. This difficulty in writing had followed Danielle into his young adulthood, so when Beatrice got a letter from him, she knew immediately that something was amiss. He would not have written if there had been any other way to convey his meaning. She had stepped on the letter as she descended the ladder. The paper had provided less grip than the rung, and so her foot had slipped and she'd nearly fallen. She jumped to the ground to avoid twisting her ankle, and there it had been before her eyes. She opened it, saw Danielle's handwriting, and closed it back up again, quick. The sight of so much of Danielle's handwriting was as troubling as the sound of his voice had been the night before. Beatrice preferred to do her hard thinking in private whenever possible, so she moved quietly away from the radio telescope behind the buildings of Bicho Raro, and over to the box truck. There was not much room beneath the truck, but she nevertheless managed to slide herself beneath it with some wiggling of first her hips and then her shoulders. Then, in the safety of that dim, small space, she sighed and opened the letter back up again. She read it. She read it again, because the letter asked her to. She read it a third time. The letter didn't ask for that, but twice had not been enough. "Beatrice, I'm in love with Marisita Lopez. It was an accident. Last night, after I was done with Tony, I helped her. That wasn't an accident. I couldn't be a coward and watch her suffer anymore. The darkness has already started to come to me. I'm going away from Bicho Raro to the wilderness, where it can't hurt anyone but me. I'm worried that if I stay, the family will be tempted to help me and bring darkness on themselves, too. I cannot live with that. I am telling her to give this letter to you and no one else, because you are the only one I can trust to be reasonable instead of kind. I'm trusting you to make them understand they can't try to find me. You better wait several hours before telling anyone to give me a head start just in case. Please. It's what I want. Read this another time so you see how much I mean it. This is only my fault and no one else should get hurt. Maybe I will be able to beat it and you will all see me again. I am sorry, but I am taking the kitchen radio. Maybe I'll be able to pick up Diablo Diablo in the evenings and it will be like you two are there with me. Please, don't tell Marisita that I love her. I don't want to make her any more hurt than she already is. Daniel. Several of the words were spelled incorrectly, and he had left out a few of them, and his emphatic but messy underline for emphasis had nearly crossed out a few syllables, but Beatrice figured it out. For several long minutes she remained under the truck, gazing at the lacy rust next to the wheels. The truck would not have ordinarily rusted so soon, not here in the dry heat of Bichoraro, but earlier in the year it had been parked too close to Marisita's lodgings and had been flooded with the salt water of her tears. Beatrice always carried a pen and one or two pieces of notebook paper folded in 2/4, and now she removed them from her pocket. Previously, she had kept a stub of a pencil instead of the pen, as she preferred the feeling of its scratching. It felt quivery and alive as it shuddered across the paper. But once she had been knocked over by the cows when they escaped their paddock, and had impaled her arm. Now she carried a pen. It was more inanimate, but also more easily hooded. Rolling onto her stomach, she began to jot down thoughts in the numbers of her secret language. How long, she mused, had Daniel been in love with Marisita Lopez, and how had it even happened? They'd been told their entire lives to keep their distance from the pilgrims, and one couldn't fall in love without getting close. Perhaps, she wrote, he was wrong. Perhaps he only felt he was in love with Marisita. But Beatrice immediately crossed this out. Daniel knew himself and his emotions in a way that no one else in Bichoraro did. If he said he was in love, he was in love. More to the point, she wrote to herself, using increasingly small numbers to preserve her paper, love would not be what killed him. He would need water in the desert, and food. He would need shelter from the bitter night cold and the attentive afternoon sun. It did not seem to be possible to bring him food or water without violating the taboo. There was also the question of his darkness. Darkness came in all shapes and sizes, and it was difficult and unpleasant to imagine what might have been lurking inside Daniel. They had all been told that Asoria's darkness was more dangerous than an ordinary pilgrim's darkness, and Beatrice had seen some fairly ominous manifestations. There was, Beatrice wrote, the possibility that his darkness was fatal. After she recorded this thought, she had to put the pen down in the dust. With a cluck of her tongue, she picked it back up. What she worried was that if she, the girl without feelings, was tempted to ignore Daniel's warning and search for him in the high desert, with the risk of bringing darkness upon them all, then the more passionate of the Sorias would be even more tempted. A pragmatic worry also pressed on Beatrice. If Daniel did not return, it would fall to her to be the saint. Like all of the Sorias, she could manage the miracle. But when a real saint performed it, it was important, spiritual. To Beatrice, it was a thing she could do, like brushing her teeth or changing oil in the truck. It did not feel like enough. If only the process was easier on the pilgrims. Often they journeyed for hundreds of miles to Bichoraro, and were already wearing thin on optimism by the time they arrived. Then, when the saint performed the first miracle, many pilgrims found their newly visible darkness just as daunting as invisible darkness, possibly more so. Despair, that opportunistic companion, slunk in, preventing them from examining themselves to perform the second miracle necessary for complete healing. And of course, the saint could not interfere. It was important, then, that the pilgrim's emotional healing be well set in motion before the first miracle ever took place, with prayer and counseling and atmosphere. With holiness, Daniel would say. Legend had it that the greatest Soria saint of all, Catalina de Luna Soria, was so holy that the first and second miracles always happened right on top of each other, the darkness appearing only to be almost immediately vanquished by the euphoric pilgrim. It was hard to imagine that now, with Bicho Raro brimming with unhealed pilgrims. It was beginning to be uncomfortable beneath the truck. Beatrice's shoulder blades pressed up against the exhaust, her hair tangled in a drivetrain component. The world outside the truck was growing louder as well. A shovel pinged against rock, and Antonia's voice lifted. She had set Pete Wyatt to work, and the sounds of their industry intruded into Beatrice's thoughts. Beatrice tried to write down a scenario where she successfully filled Danielle's shoes, but it was not a pleasant thought exercise for either her or any future pilgrims. Beatrice had acted as the saint only once, during the brief time before Danielle had repented of his sins, and after Michael had stepped down as saint to lose himself in mundane work. Although not eager to take on the role, she had been universally suggested as Michael's replacement because of her otherworldliness. Shortly after, a smart-looking financier had arrived in a smart-looking car with New York plates. Everything about him was in order. He did not even appear to have darkness inside him. But he was there for the miracle, and so she performed the miracle. Because of Beatrice's pragmatism, there was no ceremony or mystery. But because of her Soria blood, it worked anyway. The hair on the financier's head swiftly grew and curled, cascading long and lank around his face, and at the same time, his beard swiftly grew and curled, cascading long and lank down his chest. His clothing melted away, leaving him naked as the day he was born.
"This is unacceptable," the financier said, reaching to cover himself with the rug he had sat upon. But it too melted away when it touched his skin, leaving him once more naked and unshaven before Beatrice. He grasped for a wall hanging of Mary, but when the Virgin also vanished in his hands, a pity as it was an heirloom, the truth of his miracle dawned on him. The miracle had reduced him to a primitive man, bare-bodied and shaggy-headed. With poisonous anger, the financier turned upon Beatrice. This was no miracle, he told her. This was merely witchcraft, and not very good witchcraft at that. In previous generations, he continued, she would have been burned or stoned or worse. He went on to say that he could not imagine what sadistic pleasure she took in ruining successful men, but he certainly hoped she was not angling for money, since his finances had been in his pockets, which her curse had melted away. Beatrice could only quietly listen as he coldly berated her. She could not even remind him of his own role in the second miracle, lest she bring the darkness upon herself. Finally, he stood, naked of his dignity, his still-growing beard covering his manhood. With a last snarl in her direction, he stormed out of the shrine and into the night, leaving his fancy car behind. He never returned for it. Eventually, Luis sold it to a man he knew across the border. Rumors of him wandering the desert had joined those of Felipe Soria. Together, they were the wild men of Colorado. Beatrice had never performed a miracle again.
"Beatrice, Judith's looking for you," Joaquin said on one knee beside the truck.
Most people pass by box trucks without checking underneath them for other people, so it may seem surprising that Joaquin found Beatrice there. But Joaquin had many years of practice looking for Beatrice, and he knew to search for her in all of the places you might hope to find a cat or a venomous lizard. On top of roofs, hooked on tree branches, stretched in the dust beneath trucks.
"Hey, I see you under there. I said Judith is looking for you."
Beatrice had not reached a satisfactory conclusion on her scratch paper, and so did not emerge. Joaquin picked up a stick to poke at her, and then poured a little of the water from the bottle in his hand so that a slow, dusty river started moving her way.
"Your mother is yelling at your father, and Judith is yelling now, too."
She made no move to emerge, and the water stopped before it reached her,
So Joaquin unbuttoned his Hawaiian shirt and hung it on the truck's mirror to spare it from the dust and grime. Then, he too squeezed his way under the truck to lie beside his cousin. In the background was the sound of Pete's shovel dinging off hard soil and chickens barking at one another. Joaquin had managed to convince Luis to acquire aftershave for him and had doused himself in it. This musk spoke more loudly than the cousins did for several minutes, and then Joaquin said,
"What?"
Beatriz handed him her notes.
"I can't read your math recipes."
Beatriz handed him Daniel's letter. Joaquin read it, and then he read it a second time, as Daniel had advised, and then, like Beatriz, he read it a third time. He let it flutter onto his bare chest so that he could grip his hair in his palms. The theatricality of this gesture might have convinced an outsider that his feelings were spurious, but anyone who knew how Joaquin felt about his hairstyle would have realized the opposite was true.
"I hate them," he said eventually.
Beatriz replied to this in the same even way that she replied to all of Joaquin's untruths.
"No, you don't."
"Fine."
"It's not their fault. They are all children of God and Mary. El alma generosa será prosperada y el que riega será también regado."
I know.
Joaquin said in Nana's quavering voice. Then, in his own,
"We have to find a way to bring him water."
"Did you even read what he wrote?"
"Yes, but it's stupid."
"Don't make me regret showing you."
"We could ask a pilgrim to bring him water," Joaquin said, but almost immediately understood the impossibility of his own suggestion.
"If we could only speak to the pilgrims."
Beatrice gazed at the rust holes until they became a ruddy, bug-eaten leaf, and then focused into a rust hole again. To her vexation, her mind drifted to Pete Wyatt and his elbows, but her irritation dissipated when this thought solidified into an idea.
"What do you know about that man who came to work last night?"
"Man? What man?"
"Oh," Joaquin said dismissively, "that boy, you mean." Beatrice ignored the demotion.
"He's not a pilgrim. He could bring Daniel food and water."
There was silence as both cousins examined this idea for fault. When neither found any, Joaquin handed Beatrice the letter, and she folded it up again neatly. They both rolled out from underneath the truck. Joaquin collected his shirt, but didn't put it on. His skin was too dusty for him to risk sullying the fabric. Both cousins looked in the direction of Francisco Soria's greenhouse. Voices still battled from within. Joaquin said,
"We could wait until they're done."
But Beatriz set off without hesitation. If Daniel could face his darkness head on, she could face one of her parents' arguments.
Chapter 9. At one point, the tale of Francisco and Antonia Soria had been the greatest love story to ever grace Bicho Raro, which was saying a lot. Love in the high desert is a strange thing. There is something about the climate, the remoteness, the severity of the seasons, the dryness of the air, the extreme beauty, that makes people feel more deeply. Perhaps without trees or cities to dampen the enormity of the feelings, they spread out hugely. Perhaps the hard-packed dust of the San Luis Valley amplifies them, like a shout into a canyon. Whatever it is, the people of Bicho Raro were no exception. Everything was bigger. Anger, humor, terror, jubilance, love. Perhaps this was why the darkness of the Sorias was considered a more dangerous thing, too. It, like everything else, was deeper and more uncompromising. Antonia and Francisco had been born on the same minute of the same day, 100 miles apart. They might not have met if not for the weather. In the dirty 1930s, drought had struck Bicho Raro, and the air was orange and thick from dawn until dusk. There was rarely wind, and when there was, it was also orange and thick. Temperatures seared. Cattle turned to statues in the fields, and birds fell out of the sky. One day, however, a cool, clear breeze caught Francisco's hair as he was digging the family sheepdog out of a sand dune that had formed overnight. It was a strange breeze. From the north, unlike the usual southwestern weather, and when he lifted his head, he could see that the breeze was carrying blue sky with it. Clear blue air that a man could breathe without choking. He put down his shovel, and he and the dog followed the breeze clear out of Bicho Raro, down through San Luis, over the border to New Mexico, past Costilla, past Cuesta, and clear into Taos, where they were having a fiesta. Francisco, who had lived in the San Luis Valley his entire life, and under the drought for half of that life, could barely fathom such festivities. Little girls in fiesta dresses rode painted carousel horses on a merry-go-round powered by men turning a massive wooden gear. Boys 1/3 his height wore crisp and dustless sombreros. The dancing was so vigorous that he felt his legs stepping out without his permission, his body an unwitting mirror. The music replaced Francisco's blood, and he felt he could do anything. That was when the blue sky stopped, right over Antonia Alamilla, who was dancing in a white dress. He saw now that it was not blue sky at all, but rather a blue balloon whose string was tied around her wrist. When she saw Francisco in his dust-covered overalls, she immediately stopped dancing and declared in facile Spanish, "I love dogs." The rest of the townspeople looked on in shock. No one had heard Antonia speak since she'd been born, and once she had met Francisco, she did not stop. He asked her to be his wife, and when they were married in Bicho Raro 2 months later, Antonia's tears of joy coaxed rain from the sky and ended the decade-long drought. But that was before. On the day Beatriz climbed beneath the box truck to think, it was precisely 1 week before Francisco and Antonia's 50th birthdays. In honor of such a distinguished occasion, Judith had proposed a massive celebration. This was the reason she and Eduardo had returned the night before, to help prepare for such a feast. But Francisco and Antonia's union was becoming ever more fretful. Unbeknownst to Judith, they had stopped talking to each other almost entirely. Or rather, Francisco had stopped talking to Antonia. Once Antonia had begun to speak to Francisco, she had not decided to stop simply because he was not listening. The yelling Joaquin had heard was because Antonia and Judith were confronting Francisco in his greenhouse. The greenhouse was a laboratory for plants, as Francisco believed in being scientific about his quest for the art of the black rose. A system of narrow metal pipes delivered precious water precisely where he intended it to go, and reflectors were attached to shutters so that he could direct the sun similarly. There were not only roses, but also delicate lettuces that grew in a vertical grid arranged above an old claw bathtub, and secretive mushrooms that flourished in an old set of printmaker's drawers. Francisco stood among them, his hands covered in soil, his clothing covered with soil, but his hair impeccably oiled back. He had only a very few things he required to be in their places, but those things were non-negotiable.
"People will not come all this way just for you to stay in here with your roses," Antonia told him, "and do not say that there are plenty of other people here."
"No one is even asking you to help with the preparations," Judith added.
"Although she would be well within her rights," Antonia continued. "She and Eduardo came back entirely for this.
We only ask for you to promise to appear for one day out of the year. That is not so much for a wife to ask.
And don't say that your roses won't bear it, Judith said. We are supposed to be your roses.
Judith was near tears at this point. Terror had accompanied her dreams that night, even though she had slept tangled with Eduardo's warm body. She could not stop thinking of the pilgrims lurking so close to her mother's home. All her life, Antonia had warned her shrilly of the dangers of the unhealed pilgrim, and Judith had forgotten what it was like to spend every minute alongside them. She did not know how her sister, Beatriz, could bear it. But then again, her sister had no feelings, and fear was a feeling.
"We were your roses," Antonia countered hotly.
Beatriz and Joaquin arrived at this moment, and for the first time, Francisco made a sound. He said,
"Close the door, the humidity."
"What was that?"
shrilled Antonia.
"Do you believe this is a game?"
Because to her, it had not sounded like he had spoken. It had sounded as if he was making light of the situation by whistling. This was what Beatrice's invented language sounded like when it was articulated aloud. Since it was mathematical, it was far more usable in musical form than with words. Beatrice closed the door.
"Beatrice," Judith said gratefully, "you speak sense to him."
"How are your roses?" Beatrice whistled to Francisco. "Any luck?"
"Too soon to tell,"
Francisco replied to her. Father and daughter had an easy relationship that came from possessing complementary needs. Roses and tomatoes are not precisely the same, but they both flourish in the same soil. He caught the dissonant, sour note in her sentence and asked,
"Is everything all right?"
"What was that?"
Antonia stormed again. "I don't understand why I must be deliberately excluded."
The appearance of Beatrice gave Judith more strength. She said,
"What Father is doing is despicable. He's deliberately ignoring her. I arrive home last night, and she tells me that Ed and I can stay in their bedroom as she has moved into mine. Mama," I asked, "how do you and Papa fit in that room?" And she tells me that Papa stays in the greenhouse all the time and never sleeps, so she is sleeping alone now. She stays in my room because the loneliness there is smaller. How do you think I felt coming home to that news, Beatrice?"
Beatrice didn't believe she needed to think about the answer, as it seemed clearly telegraphed in Judith's tone. Judith went on.
"I don't care what they are fighting about. Papa cannot extort her in this way. It is not fair, and it is not how a husband of 40 years behaves."
"Gosh, 40 years? Joaquin said.
"I was estimating," Judith snapped.
"Is that how old you think we are?"
Antonia demanded. Judith told Francisco,
"This mistreatment won't do. You must move back into the house. You cannot turn your back on her this way. If you don't like her moods, you have to know that withholding your presence will only make it worse."
Some may have felt she was being unfair or frivolous. But for newlywed Judith, the party represented something else, a promise that a pure and passionate love was still a pure and passionate love years down the road, despite tragedy and differences in personality. It also represented security. She had remained safe at Pichoraro all these years only because she had her mother and her father standing guard over her sister and her. But now, if they had separated, anything could happen. Darkness could swallow them all. If there was not going to be a party, she wanted to flee again immediately. She would have fled again immediately if she did not love her family too much to leave them to their fates. Francisco did not reply. When he did not like the sound of something, he merely went away inside his head, where it was quieter. Beatrice joined her father and inspected the plants before him. These were not roses, nor mushrooms, nor lettuces, but instead tender garlic bulbs, broken open for investigation.
He offered her two to smell, and she did, experimentally, one, then the other.
Make him understand, Beatrice, that really all I want is to make certain that he will celebrate his birthday with the rest of us, Antonia said.
When Judith had lived at home, both she and Antonia had often exhorted either Beatrice or Francisco in this way, as if Beatrice and Francisco had feelings as a second language, and that someone who spoke fluent logic was needed to accurately convey their meaning. In reality, father and daughter were capable of deep feelings, but both were victims of that old saying, believing your own press. After years of being told they had no feelings, they began to give the opinion credence themselves, which was why Beatrice was having the crisis of decision over Daniel's letter in the first place. If she had recognized herself capable of such deep distress, she might have been able to better address it. When Beatrice didn't answer, Antonia said, clearly hurt,
"You always take his side."
Beatrice said,
"That is not true."
She did not take sides.
"It isn't," Joaquin agreed. "Beatrice is very fair."
This statement reminded Beatrice very acutely of a similar statement made by Daniel in his letter. Realizing that there would be no good time to address the task at hand, she produced the letter now without unfolding it.
"I need to tell you something. I have a letter from Daniel," she said.
"A letter?"
Antonia asked, with confusion, unable to imagine what would drive Daniel to do such a thing. Beatrice went on.
"He helped one of the pilgrims."
This news traveled into the interior of the brains in the room at different speeds. Francisco put down the garlic bulb he had been holding. Judith blinked, and then her eyes widened. Rage seized Antonia. Here are things that happen when rage overtakes you. First, your blood pressure begins to tick upward. Every escalating beat of your heart punching angrily against the walls that contain it. Your muscles tense, fisting in preparation for action. Adrenaline and testosterone leap from your glands, twin horses dragging a red-faced chariot through your thoughts. It is an interesting and peculiar twist of anger that it is jump-started in the part of our brains responsible for emotions, and it is only after the blood-boiling process has taken hold that our good old cortex, the part of the brain we rely on for thought and logic, has a chance to catch up. This is why we say stupid things when we are angry. Antonia was nearly always angry. Pacing, she ranted,
"What an idiot! He knew better! We told you all!"
"Did he say what form his darkness took?" Francisco asked calmly. His tone further fanned Antonia's rage. Beatrice shook her head.
"Soria darkness?" Judith whispered.
Fear built in her just as rage had mounted in Antonia, only it was a lighter, more feathery structure, batting around in her ribcage. Joaquin broke in.
"But we have an idea. Even if we can't help him with his darkness, he doesn't have to be helpless."
Francisco, Antonia, and Judith stared at them both, as intent as the owls that had gazed at Beatrice earlier. Beatrice added her thought.
"That boy from last night could bring him food and water. Pete Wyatt? Asoria can't help, but there's no reason why he can't interfere."
Immediately Antonia said,
"Absolutely not!"
"No," Francisco agreed. Everyone stared at him, shocked by the agreement and by the firm denial of such a simple solution.
"But why not?"
demanded Joaquin.
Antonia said, "We can't know if helping him in any way would count as interfering with his miracle, even if it is through Pete Wyatt. If it counted against us as interference, where would we be? In the same foolish place he is. And what good would that do any of us?"
She opened the door, humidity escaped, and shouted,
"Rosa! Rosa! Rosa! Come here! Oh, come here!"
She swooned against the door. Judith gasped as if she was sobbing, but she did not cry.
Oh, Mama, Judith, you're being dramatic,
Beatrice started.
You're just like your father, snarled Antonia.
Neither Francisco nor Beatrice rose to this remark. They never did.
I don't see why going through that guy is a risk, Joaquin insisted. We don't avoid the pilgrims who live here any more than that.
We can't do nothing, Beatrice said.
Look, all of you, Asoria's darkness spreads like nothing you have seen before.
Antonia's voice was ironclad.
I forbid all of you from going to find Daniel over my dead body.
Chapter 10. To understand Antonia's response to Beatrice's suggestion, you must know the story of the last time darkness came to Bicho Raro. None of the cousins except Judith had been born yet. It was only a few years after Antonia had come to live with Francisco. There were more Sorias and fewer pilgrims at Bicho Raro then. The pilgrims back then seemed to be swifter about vanquishing their darkness and heading back on their way. The Soria siblings at that time were as close as Daniel and Beatrice and Joaquin were. It was 1944, and the world was at war. Even if you had not gone to enemy territory, the enemy could come to you. In Colorado Springs, 12,000 interned German prisoners of war harvested sugar beets in work camps. Trinidad housed another 2,000 Germans. Tiny Sawatch kept 200 prisoners of war within their high school. Even Bicho Raro was not exempt. A branch work camp operated in the sugar beet field 10 miles away, and on a clear day, the sounds of Germans singing as they worked could be heard in the grazing pastures above the houses. The prisoners, separated as they were from ordinary life, were the source of much curiosity and contention. The government promised these young German men were the answer to the labor shortage in Colorado, but the Germans did not look like they belonged, with their fair, easily burned skin and their pale hair, nor did they sound like they belonged, with their marching, deliberate syllables. They did not dress like they belonged. Prisoners of war were allowed to wear their uniforms if they wished, and most of them wished, although their khaki shorts grew increasingly improbable as the year marched toward winter. And winter was dark that year. Winter in this part of the country was a frozen place. Temperatures plummeted in the desert and snow heaped over the memory of the scrub. Nothing moved. Survival happened by having a warm hole to wait in. If you had not built or found one by the time the blizzards hit, folks relayed the ending of your story with tears and a beer. Unlike much of the world, Bicho Raro was enjoying a time of prosperity due to the previously mentioned windfall from Elizabeth Pantazopoulos. So although it was bitter outside and claustrophobic inside, there was plenty of food and comfort to be had. It was a grim evening when a strange pilgrim came to Bicho Raro. It had been snowing for the entire week, and it was still snowing then, the bored snowfall of a sky that cannot think of anything better to do. It was neither light nor dark, just gray. Everyone was inside when the owls began to make a commotion. They lifted from roofs, sending snow coughing down to the ground, and launched themselves in the direction of the newcomer. He was still trudging a half a mile off, but the owls went straight to him and doubled back to Bicho Raro, and then back to him again, half mad with the promise of the darkness and the miracle. Antonia Soria was the first out to greet him when he stumbled into Bicho Raro. She had made it only a few yards into the knee-high snow when she stopped. It had become clear to her that he was one of the Germans. She didn't see much more than his uniform before she went back into the house for Francisco and a gun. She was joined by others.
the oldest brother, Jose, and also Michael and Rosa Soria, and their curious sister, Loyola, who was Daniel's mother, and gentle Benjamin, who was Daniel's father, and the current saint. Loyola was very pregnant at this time with Daniel, and should not have been out in the cold, but she did not take many steps without Antonia. The two had been the very best of friends since Antonia had come to live at Bicho Raro.
"Bita," the German said.
His knees were knocking together with the cold, and they were bright red. He was wearing his uniform shorts, and the snow had soaked right through his socks and pressed up against his bare knees for miles. Antonia raised the shotgun warningly.
"Bita,"
the German said again. This was because his arms had a child in them. The child's face was the same color as the German's knees, the ugly red of too much cold. Because he spoke very little English and no Spanish, there was no way for the German to tell the Sorias how he came to be holding the child. He was barely a child himself.
"Where did you escape from?"
asked Francisco. But of course the German didn't understand this either. The owls were sweeping low and desperate around him as he staggered close, not looking at the shotgun, and offered the child to Michael. Now, it must be said that it is a funny thing to be able to perform miracles. Having the ability to help someone does not automatically go hand in hand with the ability to know when it's the right time to help someone. One is left looking at strangers who are clearly in need of aid, and wondering if the saint can merely attend to their needs, or if the saint is required to ask the would-be recipient first. The German clearly needed a miracle. It was not as if they could ask him, though. No one there spoke a lick of German. Benjamin weighed his responsibility in the matter and the level of earnestness on the German's face, and made the decision that because the German had been kind to this child, Benjamin owed him kindness as well. He performed the miracle. At once, the German let out a small cry of surprise, put down the child in his arms, and transformed into a large-eared kit fox. Benjamin had anticipated this, or something like it. What he hadn't anticipated was that the miracle would also operate on the child the German had brought. Benjamin had not considered it would be possible for such a small toddler to have darkness in him. But the child's hands began to turn into dragon scales, and as they did, the child roused from his stupor and, in fright, began to cry. What does it mean to interfere with a miracle? It is not rightly known what counts as helping pilgrims to heal themselves. It is not the indirect care of providing a roof over their heads, as they did at Bicho Raro, or the direct care of providing food for their bowl. But it was sometimes the indirect kindness of allowing a pilgrim to play a card game with you, or the direct kindness of offering advice. Better to keep one's distance, the Sorias had decided, than to try to predict what might count as interference. But Benjamin did not think about this as he offered comfort to the crying child. He was not thinking about the child's miracle at all, really, as he had only intended to help the German. And for him, like for most, there was not much that the head had to do with hearing a crying child and moving toward it. That was all in the heart. It took no time for the Soria darkness to manifest in Benjamin. Soria darkness, as said before, is faster and more terrible than the usual pilgrim's darkness. Benjamin had barely spoken to the child when he let out a gasp. His legs had gone sprawled and odd, a foal's leg scrabbling for footing in the snow. He could not see it, but his legs were beginning to turn to wood. Loyola, unknowing, asked him what was wrong. She tugged up his snow-crusted pants leg to reveal grey, spindly wood, dry logs like you would find left in the sand.
"Oh, Benjamin, I will love you anyway," she told him,
And even this phrase, this small comfort, counted against her, and now the darkness began to fall upon her too. She became wood from the top down.